The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Mike Gallagher, in this week for Hugh Hewitt. The Senate GOP health care bill to repeal and replace Obamacare is toast. Senate Majority Leader McConnell sums things up.
Republicans by themselves are not prepared at this particular point to do a replacement.
Hugh wrote about it in his column this week for the Washington Post.
Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul D. Ryan face a very difficult choice as they survey the smoking ruins of their, quote, unified GOP government after nearly 6 months in office.
As the 2018 midterms loom, will conservatives be run out of town because they've failed at governing?
2018 will be the most defining election in which the American people get to decide who they want to craft the long-term solutions for our health care system.
And Professor John Eastman weighs in on the lingering liberal fixation over presidential collusion with Russia.
There's nothing illegal to be on the receiving end of opposition research that had been done about a candidate. I'm trying to think what law that violates.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Mike Gallagher. Great to be with you. You can learn more about my show at MikeOnline.com. That's MikeOnline.com. On Wednesday, the seven-year promise by Republicans to fix health care pretty much crashed and burned. Liberal media, at least those who aren't fixated on the Trump-Russia collusion stories, blasted out celebratory headlines like Senate GOP health care bill doomed. Salem contributor and Hoover Institution fellow Lanhee Chen posted commentary referring to the several GOP senators who torpedoed the Republicans' historic opportunity to rescue the country from its terrible health care mess.
Unfortunately, several Republican senators voiced their opposition to even considering the bill, closing the door on the debate. A number did so because they didn't think it went far enough. Others did so because they thought it went too far. Whatever their reasoning, these senators have effectively enshrined Obamacare as a law of the land, and they have turned their backs on a promise that they and other Republicans have been making for years. For these failures, they have only themselves to blame. I'm Lanhee Chen.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell faced the media with resignation.
This has been a very, very challenging experience for all of us. It's pretty obvious that we don't have 50 members who can agree on a replacement. A lot of people have been involved in the discussions, been very passionate discussions, but everybody's given it their best shot. And as of today, we just simply do not have 50 senators who can agree on what ought to replace the existing law. What we do have is a vote that many of us made 2 years ago at a time when the President of the United States would not sign the legislation that would repeal Obamacare and, with a two-year delay, give us an opportunity to build something better on a bipartisan basis. Republicans by themselves are not prepared at this particular point to do a replacement. And that doesn't mean the problems all go away. And you'll have to look at our committee chairman and their ranking members. My suspicion is there'll be hearings about the crisis that we have, and we'll have to see what the way forward is.
Two of the naysaying senators, Susan Collins and Rand Paul, were predictable. Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin had to be exceedingly short-sighted. They may well pay a price. Hugh Hewitt called out this destructive pack of six in his column for the Washington Post.
I wrote a piece after the collapse, after Mike Lee betrayed conservative principles and deserted the cause, along with Jerry Moran of Kansas, joining Susan Collins and Rand Paul from the Planet Paul, in opposing Obamacare. Those four now own it, along with Dean Heller and Ron Johnson. They're the Obamacare Republicans, and they killed repeal and replace. And today or later in the week, Senator McConnell is going to bring forward a straight repeal plus two-year transition. And a different set of actors may kill that. But I wrote a piece for the Washington Post last night about what should the Republicans do next. It reads, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul D. Ryan face a very difficult choice as they survey the smoking ruins of their, quote, unified GOP government after nearly 6 months in office. They and their lieutenants could decide to pivot from health care to racking up small victories and awaiting reinforcements from the 2018 elections, or they could go for a big deal with Democrats. It's a tough choice for Ryan and McConnell, but I'm hoping they opt for the big deal. Putting off fixing the disaster that is Obamacare is risky, though not impossible. If Republicans score enough small victories between now and November 2018, cutting corporate taxes, confirming all Court of Appeals judges, perhaps next summer another member of the Supreme Court, it may be possible to hold both houses of Congress. Senator Dean Heller, Republican of Nevada, is a dead man walking for his role in pulling the first thread that led to the unraveling of repeal and replace. But Senator McConnell might calculate that wins in Florida, Missouri, and elsewhere may leave him in a stronger position in January 2019 than he was at the start of this year. Ryan is in more dangerous terrain, as every member of his caucus owns the failure to repeal and replace, especially the Freedom Caucus, which threw the process into disarray only to retreat too late with a fig leaf, and as a result, the carnage of the collapsing Obamacare experiment. Real people with real illnesses and deeply flawed Medicaid insurance will discover in increasing numbers that paper insurance doesn't deliver real health care when their children are sick. A watch-it-fail approach to Obamacare, when the crisis is real and the consequences for poor children are so enormous, is not just bad politics, it is also immoral. The alternative to waiting for 2019 is a bipartisan approach, if Democrats will have it. A health care deal could be done, leaving the fringes of both party caucuses on the outside looking in. Devolution of authority over Medicaid to the states and repeal of the insurance mandate and absurd taxes such as the medical device tax or the GOP must-haves. The Democrats will have their list. Odds of success increase if the parties go big at the start of removing the sequester, at the start, by removing the sequester's limits on defense spending and adding immigration reform to the deal. Appropriations for President Trump's wall, paired with legalization of the law-abiding undocumented population but with no path to citizenship. A truly ambitious go-big option could also include a settlement of the judicial confirmation wars, because the more the moving parts, the better the chances of success. McConnell, Ryan, and Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi could get together with a half dozen of the smartest members from both parties to work on an expedited basis and go big. The GOP Congress has failed. Unless there's a Lazarus-like resurrection of the health care bill, the session is effectively over. Tax reform isn't likely to do any better than health care reform, especially with the Wall Street Journal ideologues demanding the end of the state and local income tax deduction and the capping of the mortgage interest deduction. F.A. Hayek doesn't vote in large numbers. Blue state voters with Republican congressmen do. The GOP must get its appellate court nominees through the Senate, or the party wipeout could expand to seats previously thought safe. The 2018 prospects look bad for both parties. The GOP lacks policy victories thanks to the imprudent Freedom Caucus members and scared moderates. The Democrats are lost in Trump hatred to the point where the large part of the country thinks that they and the mainstream media are deranged. Both parties have cause for concern. We are at a crisis point where citizens are giving up on representative government en masse. So why not swing for the fences?
Prior to the GOP senatorial collapse, Senator Lindsey Graham, seeing the likely outcome, posed some interesting alternatives. He was a guest on my show.
Bill Cassidy and I have come up with an idea that I think is a pretty creative idea. Take all the money we're going to spend on Obamacare, do away with the individual mandate, the employer mandate, and send the money and policy making back to the states and let them decide what to do with it, not us in Washington.
And a lot of us love the idea of letting the states decide. That's sort of music to many, many of Americans' ears. First of all, let's go back to the Better Care Reconciliation Act and what you and Senator Cassidy want to do. And I've had a lot of assistance, by the way, from Kimberly Leonard over at the Washington Examiner, who's real good at this stuff, and she follows this and reports on it. And she's been kind of giving me a lot of input. We had her on the show this week. First of all, can you explain to us the bill itself? Let's talk about the bill and so that we can have a good understanding of it.
Okay, our proposal?
Yeah, let's talk about the amendment. Senator Cassidy have an amendment to the Better Care Reconciliation Act, right?
So Rick Santorum called me about three or four months ago, I had a deal with John Barrasso to allow states to opt out of Obamacare about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you don't like being in Obamacare, opt out. We'll give you the same amount of money, more flexibility. You design your own alternative to Obamacare. Rick called and said, you know, that's a good idea, but let's go further. Let's just say to every state, here's the money. You can't spend it on roads and bridges. You design a health care system that meets the needs of your state. So mm-hmm. that's what got me off and running. Cassidy is on board. Here's what we would do. We would repeal the individual mandate, the employer mandate. We would repeal the medical device tax because that hurts medical innovation. Would leave the other taxes in place. It's about $500 billion over 10 years. We would block grant that money back to every state, do a formula that's fair, and tell them, you design an alternative to Obamacare. If you like Obamacare, repair it. It's up to you. To me, get the money in policymaking outside of Washington destroys single-payer health care. Mm-hmm. So Obamacare will collapse, but Obamacare was designed to collapse. It was designed to make sure that employers would drop coverage because it's too expensive, that exchanges would fail, and the government would come in and take over, and you'd have single-payer health care. What I'm trying to do is cut off at the pass single-payer health care by taking the money and the policy and getting it out of Washington. If you do what I'm talking about, there'll never be single-payer health care. What I'm doing with Cassidy and Rick Santorum is just a more Republican way of dealing with the issue. You keep the money in place, but you write the check to governors and local government rather than to Washington bureaucrats, and you allow them to innovate. So mm-hmm. we've got to get something done. Health Obamacare is collapsing. If it does collapse, then you can sit down and work with Democrats to find an alternative. But what's changed my mind is talking to governors. I've had three governors call me in the last 24 hours very excited about the idea. If you give me this money and hold me accountable, mm-hmm. then we're going to deliver for the people in our state. They're looking for the flexibility that Obamacare denies them. They're looking for resources, and I'm going to trust them to deliver. The government closest to the people is usually the best government. Health care closest to the patient is probably the best health care.
Have you had a chance to talk to President Trump about your plan?
President Trump called me before he left to go to France. Mm-hmm. Mark Meadows, who's the Freedom Caucus guy, and I have been talking about a block grant approach. The governor of Utah called me and said he's been talking about this for months. Mm-hmm. President Trump likes the idea of draining the swamp. If you take the policy and money out of Washington, you drain the swamp in terms of federal government takeover of health care. The federal government runs Medicare. It runs Medicaid. The only thing left is people who make too much to be on Medicaid under 65. I'd like to keep a private sector market in place. And the way to do that is allow each state to set up systems that work best for them.
Coming up, Iran gets another pass.
Several administration officials want a little more time to preserve the status quo to complete their review of Iran policy. That's a prudent step to take, but it's getting time to stop reviewing and start deciding.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mike Gallagher in for Hugh Hewitt. Reporting from the major news outlets has been filled with coverage of the GOP's struggling efforts on health care reform and rumors of the Trump-Russia collusion. All this has left little space for the public to learn of the still festering Iran nuclear deal. Recall that the Obama administration's agreement with Iran, effective January 2016, was filled with ambiguity. Many military experts saw it as a dangerous risk to our nation's security. Yes, we do have periodic certifications by the administration measuring Iran's compliance. Last week, the Trump administration, quote, grudgingly certified that Iran is meeting the terms of the agreement, but only after deliberations within the administration. Hugh Hewitt turned to Senator Tom Cotton, chair of the Armed Services Subcommittee on Emerging Threats.
Let me ask you about the Iran decision, because this is being lost in the healthcare debacle. The president agreed to go along with the Iran deal on the urging of many peoples in his administration. I am disappointed by that decision. What's your reaction, Senator Cotton?
I'm disappointed as well, Hugh. I understand the perspective of several administration officials. I think the president's heart and his instincts are with us, Hugh. But he has many respected officials working for him who want a little more time to preserve the status quo to complete their review of Iran policy. That's a prudent step to take, but it's getting time to stop reviewing and start deciding. Now, the case I made to Secretary Tillerson last week was that we don't have to certify under the Corker-Cardin legislation. Passed 2 years ago, 98-1, I was the one vote against it. One of the certifications required is under that legislation that this deal, even if Iran is complying with it entirely, is in the vital national security interests of the United States. I wouldn't make that certification. I wouldn't say those words. The president said the opposite during the campaign. And, Hugh, remember, under the legislation, the only consequence of failing to make that certification is that Congress can pass a law to impose sanctions. Well, Congress can do that now. So you shouldn't listen to the media, to the Democrats, saying that failure to make that certification would somehow blow up the deal or violate our obligations. It has nothing to do with the terms of the deal itself. It's only under that legislation.
The media hype over Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 presidential campaign is still in high gear. The count on meeting participants has now reached 8. Although elite media outlets and most Democrats are clamoring for the president's head based on the meeting, some legal minds are not impressed. My Salem colleague Larry Elder recently spoke with Professor John Eastman, former dean of the Chapman University School of Law.
One of the articles I read in The Hill by Kaylee McEnany, who's an opinion contributor, is that despite all of the hyperventilation, it turns out that both Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort had disclosed this meeting before the New York Times reporting.
Well, I think that's right. But I think what we've got going on here is what the psychologists call transference. I mean, the news that's coming out today that indicates this meeting was a setup, that it was actually coordinated by people at the Hillary Clinton campaign, that they were the ones that were working with the Russians to try and build this narrative that it was the Trump campaign working with the Russians. I mean, if somebody calls me and I'm in the heat of a campaign and says, we've got some opposition research on your opponent, do you want it? There's no campaign in the country that doesn't say yes to that. and there's no crime to get that kind of information.
John, what I'm hearing from pundits on primarily CNN and MSNBC is, I've worked in campaigns before, and people come to us all the time with opposition on our opponent, and we accept it, but I've never been approached by a foreign government, and had I been, I'd have picked up the phone and I'd have called the FBI.
Yeah, well, that's nonsense. We know, for example, the so-called dossier on Donald Trump during the campaign was created by the campaign in collusion with foreign sources in Great Britain, working with foreign sources in Russia, and very likely involving folks working within the Obama administration in government positions itself. So the notion that they would not do that, they've done it, and they apparently did it here as well. It was apparently the connections with the folks that requested this meeting and the Clinton campaign and the DNC are very strong, and it looks like it was designed to set up a situation to build a narrative down the road. It's just astounding to me that the media are going so apoplectic over this when it looks like the thing was originated in the opposing camp.
John, suppose they had assumed this was a Russian national. Suppose all three of them assumed that this woman was, in fact, representing the government of Russia. Does that change your analysis?
Well, I don't think so. There's nothing illegal to be on the receiving end of opposition research that had been done about a candidate. I'm trying to think what law that violates. Now, one thing is very clear, we've had this. I mean, you go back to the Pentagon Papers case or what have you. If you're involved in acquiring the information illegally, then you can be indicted and convicted. But to be on the receiving end of information that's relevant to your campaign or relevant to a political cause or what have you, if you had no connection with the illegal gathering of it, that's not itself a crime.
John, I saw Donald Trump Jr. last night on Hannity, and I wish he had said what you said. He kept saying over and over again, she had nothing of value. It's irrelevant whether she had nothing of value. It's okay for you to take the meeting. That's he should right. have said that.
That's right. Well, you know, I don't think he's a lawyer. I don't think he understands the finer comb on this. And the notion that the Russians are trying to influence. But you read that email. I mean, you read that email, and it's just so patently obvious that it's a setup. We've got government information to try and help your dad influence the election. Well, it's like it was written to create a narrative after the fact. I wouldn't have taken the meeting, but he did and found there was no relevant
information. And in that connection, John, a number of people are calling Donald Trump Jr. naive, if not stupid. I think one headline in the New York Post was Donald Trump Jr. is stupid. Okay, what about Paul Manafort? He is not inexperienced in these kinds of things. Why did he go along with the meeting? Why didn't he stop it?
Well, you know, if I'm running a campaign and somebody comes up with an email like that is so facially obvious to be, some setup, I think I would go and I would try and find out what exactly it is they're peddling.
Mm-hmm.
because it gives you a good insight into the opposition tactics of the opposing forces. So I wouldn't shy away from that. I don't want to attribute naivete to either Mr. Trump Jr. or Mr. Manafort on that.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would. Somebody's offering me that kind of information.
Right.
It looks suspicious to me, and I will certainly look at whatever they give me with a very jaundiced eye. But, you know, think about it in terms of war. Somebody from the other army contacts me and says, I've got top secret information of where our landing's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to hear what they have to say, and then I will discredit it or credit it as I think it's verifiable.
John, Donald Trump Jr. last night repeatedly said his father was not informed of this meeting because he did not think it was a big deal. Why is it relevant whether he informed his father or not? It seems to me that if he had picked up the phone and called his dad and said, I had this meeting, it went to nothing, that doesn't make the case any more damaging.
Well, it doesn't because, you know, there's no there at the outset. And so we keep piling inference upon inference upon inference to lead to an impeachment allegation when there is nothing that was wrong in the very first step. And so, you know, with nothing at the first step compiled, second step, third step, fourth step, you still don't get anything. All you have is either set up by the Clinton campaign and the DNC or somebody wanting to say, look, we've got a bunch of stuff on Clinton. They may have been peddling to the Clinton campaign the stuff they had on Trump.
Coming up,
you don't want to do anything, even for purposes of politics and crisis management, that puts somebody in jail.
Advice from an expert on presidential crises when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. Get the podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. That's townhallreview.com. I'm Mike Gallagher, in for Hugh Hewitt. During the Clinton administration, the country witnessed what we could very well describe as crisis mismanagement. Many of you may remember Lanny Davis, who served as special counsel to President Bill Clinton from 96 to 98, including the period of Clinton's impeachment proceedings. Lanny has now put his lessons learned into a memoir of that era, into a book called Tell It Early, Tell It All, Tell It Yourself. Lanny Davis joined me on my show with the Trump White House and their crisis management as context. We're in a place, it's very polarizing, and Lanny, you've been at this a long time. I suspect you'd agree, it's never been quite this bad before, has it?
You know, I wrote a book in 2010 where I said it's never been quite this bad, reflecting back on the Newt Gingrich days when Bill Clinton was president, and it was pretty bad. And then in 2010, with President Obama as president and so much hostility between the parties, I thought it was as bad as it's ever going to get. But this is worse than ever. So maybe we've reached the bottom, and we can only go up.
Well, let's hope, because you're so right. Let's disagree and have civil conversations about policy and the direction of the country. But the personal stuff, the nasty stuff, the attacks, the threatening tone, it's really troublesome. And that's why, you know, I was reading your piece in The Hill, and I thought, you know, this is free advice to President Trump's
lawyer, from Bill Clinton's lawyer, get out in front of this. And so walk us through your message about all these stories that much of the media is centered on now, with the meeting with Don Jr. and the Russians, and if you were advising President Trump in an official capacity, what would you be telling him to do?
Well, this is a tough one because you don't want to do anything, even for purposes of politics and crisis management, mm-hmm. that puts somebody in jail. So anybody that is subject to a possible criminal offense, I always say, you can't follow my advice. You need a criminal defense lawyer. But the president of the United States is very unique. He cannot be criminally prosecuted, at least until he leaves office. And so he's the leader of the American people in the best sense of politics. He's there because of a democratic process. So he needs to look past potential criminal liability, and he needs to think about the institution of the presidency and what's best for the American people. In my column, I say you've got to be completely 100% transparent, Mr. President, and Mr. Cobb, your lawyer, has to convince you that even if that puts your presidency in peril, it's your best chance to get out of this without being in peril, because sooner or later all this stuff is coming out anyway.
You know, and the challenge that many of us face in hearing that advice is that we doubt that there's a good faith effort on the part of many of President Trump's critics to just get to the truth. In other words, this is about tearing him down, stopping the agenda, stopping stopping him in his tracks. So how do you balance what I believe truly is a sincere good faith bit of advice on your part from those who are trying so hard to find anything they can to pin on President Trump and this administration? How do you distinguish between the two?
You know, first of all, I agree with you. Whether it's a Democratic president or Republican president, in these partisan times, there are a lot of people who just want to tear down and destroy President Trump and not give him a fair shake.
Right.
And they are on my side of the aisle. And sometimes it's something I think about. So that's part of a human partisan instinct, because there's been a lot of attacks back and forth between President Trump and Democrats, and it just keeps going. So the answer is, you're right. It is a reason to pause. I used to be told in the White House when I was defending President Clinton, whose side are you on anyway? I put as a chapter title of the book I wrote about my experience that title, whose side are you on?
Right.
So the only answer to why do it if it's just going to give ammunition to people who are only interested in tearing President Trump down is, you're right, but what's the alternative? It's drip, drip, drip.
Right.
And
right.
He can't get to his agenda without getting this story behind him.
And incidentally, I would be the first to admit, Lanny, that this is a two-way street. You know, you're right. When people instinctively, it's back to this debate we're having right now in the Trump era, the tribal nature of political partisanship.
Well, I'm sorry to say that there are people on both sides that are hopeless in being completely dominated by the emotion of hate,
right,
and anger. Right. So to answer your question, President Trump, whatever knowledge or none, whatever the facts are, the best way to save his agenda and get the country focused on the problems that need to be solved is to follow my advice on crisis management and getting the story out.
Coming up,
there are 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 54 who are neither working nor looking for work.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mike Gallagher in for Hugh Hewitt. Over the course of the past 6 months, as our economy struggles to its feet, we're finally starting to hear some positive reports on employment. You might think that the country is pretty close to full employment, given that we are issuing thousands of guest worker visas. This doesn't square with the stats in Nick Eberstadt's latest book, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. The expert from the American Enterprise Institute was a recent guest of my colleague, Michael Medved.
First of all, the dimensions of this problem, we're not talking about a small number of individuals. We're talking about a national trend.
absolute national trend. It's been going on for half a century, gradually getting worse, not year by year, but decade by decade. There are 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 54, prime working age, they're called in the jargon, who are neither working nor looking for work. And if we look at the work rate, the employment to population ratio, it is worse today for that group than it was in 1940 at the tail end of the Great Depression, when the national unemployment rate was over 14%. So it's not hyperbolic to say we have a depression-scale crisis in employment for men in our nation today.
If, as you do in your book, you actually take a look at the demographics of this group of people, the 7 million people who just have chosen not to work or even to look for work. First of all, who are they?
Well, I mean, if you have a group of 7 million, you're probably going to have pretty much some of everybody, but some are overrepresented. If we talk ethnically, African Americans are overrepresented in that group. But interestingly enough, among people of color, both Asian Americans and Latinos are underrepresented. They're more likely to be in the workforce than the national average. With education, I don't think there are any surprises. People who are high school dropouts are way overrepresented. College grads and graduate degree types are underrepresented. An important aspect is family structure and marital status. No matter what your educational background, married guys are less likely to be in this pool. Guys who have children at home are less likely to be in this pool. Guys who have never been married are more likely to be in the pool. And with respect to what is called nativity, whether you were born in America or not, foreign-born guys are more likely to be in the workforce than guys who are born in the States.
So, in other words, people who are foreign-born, whether they're legal or illegal immigrants, are less likely to be out of the workforce. They're more likely to be working.
Exactly. And interestingly enough, that's not just for Hispanic. Every single ethnic group in our country, it's true for. No matter what your ethnicity, if you were born abroad, you're more likely to be in the game than if you were born here in the States.
How do these people live? In other words, when you're talking about 7 million people, some of those individuals are seriously disabled, right? And what percentage of that 7 million who have just dropped out of the workforce, aren't even trying to work, are so disabled that they really couldn't work?
It's a very important question, and it's a hard one to put a decimal point on, Michael, but I think we can see that over time, the death rate, the mortality level, the risk of death for working-age American guys has steadily come down, while the proportion of guys on disability benefits has steadily gone up. That's a sort of a what is wrong with this picture sort of trend, right?
In other words, they're not really in more serious health problems. They're just taking disability payments more.
Well, it is true, and it's a cause for considerable concern that death rates for the non-Hispanic whites, for the Anglos, for both women as well as men, have risen in recent years. This is only true for Anglos. It's not true for African Americans or for Latinos or for Asian Americans.
Let's go to Brenda in Phoenix, Arizona. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Nicholas Eberstadt.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two grown sons, both 25 years old. They come from a family that my husband and I both have two jobs. These boys do not work, and we have owned our own companies, have put them to work in our own companies, and even put one of the sons as a partner on my LLC, and he still won't work. And they're both married. It's ridiculous.
What do?
They sit around and watch videos all day. one of them actually takes care of his kids while his wife goes out and works as a nurse. And she married him like that. And I don't understand it. It just drives me nuts.
Uh-huh. Brenda, do they take any government benefits or they just live off you and their wives?
Well, they don't live off me. I'll tell you that right now. I kicked them out.
Good for you.
Both of them are on Access, which is the Medicaid. And that has, again, when we're just giving them stuff, they're going to keep taking it. My son told me, Mom, I'll just live in people's houses until they throw me out. And I said, you're never going to live like that. Well, that was 10 years ago when he was 15 and he's still doing it.
Brenda, I know someone like that. One of my roommates in college has lived for 30 years like that. Really?
I know.
It's terrible.
It's embarrassing. By
the way, do you think your sons might be listening? They probably don't listen to this radio show because they're too busy playing video games.
Or they're asleep because, you know, it is, 12 noon somewhere. They're
going to
be asleep.
Brenda, you sound absolutely wonderful. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Quick comment, Nick Eberstadt.
You know, it's hard to speak about individual cases, but it's certainly true that in this 7 million man army, the proportion of guys who are basically checked out of civil society, not using their enormous amounts of free time for charitable work, volunteering, helping around the house, helping other people, is really, really striking.
Coming up, a controversial tweet from my colleague.
I stand by every word that I wrote. I only wish I had added universities.
Dennis Prager in the final segment of the Town Hall Review after this.
Hey, mama, don't you treat me wrong. Come and love you, daddy, all night long, all right now. Hey, hey.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mike Gallagher. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager recently had some splaining to do. A recent tweet from Dennis got him into a little bit of hot water. Media folks on both sides of the political aisle were angry with him. Hugh Hewitt turned to Dennis to sort through it all on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Dennis was just on Fox and Friends, my friend and colleague on the Salem Radio Network. Let's listen to that.
What's a bigger threat to America, fake news or Russia? Radio talk show host Dennis Prager recently tweeting this. The news media in the West pose a far greater danger to Western civilization than Russia does.
All right, joining us right now to discuss is the host of the Dennis Prager Show, Dennis Prager. Dennis, threat? Really?
You know, I have to tell you, this may sound odd to, I don't know if to you, but to many of the viewers, I don't understand why the tweet is controversial. Putin does not threaten Western civilization. Western civilization is a set of ideas and values. When students remove the American flag from their campuses, that's not Putin. All of the things that are happening in the West to undo Western civilization have nothing to do with Putin. The only thing I regret about the tweet is that I didn't write the universities and the media in the West are a greater threat to Western civilization.
All right, now, Dennis, let's go to your controversial tweet. Dennis Prager on July 14th wrote on Twitter, "The news media in the West pose a far greater danger to Western civilization than Russia does." Now, Dennis, I think I'm a pretty good friend of yours. I don't agree with you on this tweet, on both what it says, but more importantly, how it was perceived. I think it was obvious that it was going to be perceived as you writing, "Members of the media are more evil than Putin." You did not intend that, did you?
If that's what people infer, then really honesty is not possible any longer. Listen, the news media pose a greater threat to Western civilization than Kim Jong-un, who is the embodiment of evil on Earth. Do I think that the New York Times editorial board has anybody on it that comes close to the evil of Kim Jong-un?
Leo Strauss wrote in the beginning of The City and Man, "The West will never be in crisis, even if it is defeated, if its ideas remain strong and defended." So,
yes,
but right now they're being corroded by the university.
So why was my tweet wrong?
Because it's perceived as saying that the mainstream media is more evil.
It's misperceived.
That's right. It is misperceived. Okay. But if we know it's going to be abused, why go in harm's way?
Yes. Okay. I have spent my life trying to say truths as directly as possible, and I stand by every word that I wrote. I only wish I had added universities.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes on our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or Google Play. While you're at it, please rate our show. It really helps others find us. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, Derek Fowler, David Posian, Eric Hansen, and Lance Anderson. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the Week in Review program from a perspective you can trust.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.